Poet Under a Soldier's Hat. Preface. If I'd never met the naked colonel, never heard his ranting conformity kills and compromise castrates, I might have remained a soldier, trapped in my father's footsteps like the wriggling worm I discovered imprisoned in the geranium urn when I was 4. I might never have allowed a single poem to flower, climbed where I should not have climbed, or created an oasis in Aden's desert. I was a desert frog, voiceless, silent, lying in wait for the rains to come before I could sing and mate. I first felt the splatter, the fat drops of rain on my upturned face, when trekking in the wildness of the Himalayas when I was a man. Brief moments of dreamy solitude kept me alive until then, when the rains I knew would come some day arrived, and I would sing, full-throated. Until then, poor voiceless child, I trod blindly in footprints not my own. It's my story and my family's story that compels me to peer through the spyglass into a time that can never be again. History and details of lives caught in 2 world wars, the Indian Mutiny, the Raj, and the British Empire across the breadth of India and Arabia. I want you to know about my experiences serving alongside the Gurkha regiments and Indian Army on the northwest frontier and the hill stations, about my 4 years with the Foreign Service in India, Arabia, Iran, and Waziristan, and of the eventual crumbling of my military career. Escape, capture, bandits, warlords, missionaries, officers, ordinary men, and ghosts. I want a record to exist, and a record of my personal adventures and struggles, my mountain treks and mysterious encounters, for which I have no explanation. Until partition in 1947, both branches of my family were tied to India, though by 2 very different strings. Father's background was traditional, military, pucker British, one might say. Mother's was, well, different, starting with her birth in the ruins of a Hindu temple in the jungle, her mixed blood, her parents' narrow escape from death on the very day the Indian mutiny broke out in Meerut in 1857. I have my grandfather's eyewitness account. Then there was the big secret, something taboo in my parents' past, something shocking, which, if I had uncovered earlier, known, it might have made it easier to step out of father's footsteps. I might have become a full-time writer and a poet, rather than a soldier who kept poems under his hat. But I didn't. I'll begin. Hugh the Child, Chapter 3, Hugh Vincent Rose. When news of my birth reached father in India, he recorded the event with a joyless comment in his game journal, alongside details of the day's shoot. "Presented with a new son today, April 11th, 1905. Bagged 6 partridge, 1 peahen, brace of silver pheasant, and a fair-sized black buck. Fresh tiger scat." After his death in the 80s, I scanned page upon page of neatly written entries recording his kills. Tiger, duck, partridge, buck, and wild boar and peahen, searching, searching. Military expeditions featured as one-line entries in his diaries. Skirmish, land decay, bad mash, executed, village fined 500 rifles. No mention of family, no mention of me. Nameless. A new son. Hurtful I met so little. The impressive tome was reserved for important events. But I existed. Hugh Vincent Rose, April 11th, 1905. I carried his name. As his first legitimate son, I was named Hugh in keeping with Rose tradition. I was born in a lying-in hospital in North Church, a small village in southern England. In the summer of 1906, I was already a toddler when father and I first met. True to pattern, he was home from India on a 2-month furlough. Cowed by his booming military voice, I literally clung to mother's skirts whenever he was around. I didn't like his whiskers, the colour of his skin, sallow from long exposure to the Indian sun. His tobacco smell stuck in my throat. I didn't like the way he looked at my mother as he shooed me from my place beside her in bed. Our bed. I wanted him to go away. He mostly ignored me, seeing me for the mewling weakling I was, and just one more annoying mouth to feed. "What do you have to say for yourself, boy? Speak up, milksop, namby-pamby," he'd sneer. But I hadn't mastered intelligible speech, so stared mutely in reply. When he returned on his next leave, I was almost four. I could speak by then, but round him spoke only when spoken to. "Yes, sir. No, sir. Good morning. Good night, sir." Not yet four, I stood when he entered the room. Mother had coached me well. I avoided his angry hand. I feared him as I feared the giant ogre in Jack and the Beanstalk, come to grind my bones to make his bread. I clung to Teddy. I sucked his paw.
"Don't let me see you again with that baby toy of yours. Take it from him, Mother."
I wept. Mother obeyed, of course. But when I went to bed, Teddy was waiting for me on my pillow. "He's happier here," she whispered. "Teddy's like playing at night." During furlough spent with us, Father was miserable. We were miserable. Unused to domesticity and hating our cramped, crowded home, he fretted, impatient for the interlude to end. Sitting up, formal around the dinner table, our pudding long since demolished, Father ate his angels on horseback, or Welsh rabbit, a savoury which only he was served. We'd wriggle, waiting. Then it came.
"Now in Indra,"
at which opening words Mother tried her utmost to deflect him with constant interruptions. "Pass the water jug to Father, Rita. Eileen, clear the plates, there's a dear. Hugh, sit up straight, elbows off the table." Unstoppable, ignoring Mother's pursed lips, on and endlessly on he battered us, his captive audience, with lavish tales.
"Now in Indra, in the Raj, by Jove, that's the life. We Sahibs never picked up so much as a kerchief. My personal bearer dresses me, pulls off my boots, shaves me while I read the London Times, out of date, of course, brings a trotter-peg of whiskey while I have my bath."
At home, his orderlies were us, Mother his bearer. The furlough when I was four, 3 weeks before he returned to India, Father sprung one of his surprises halfway through dinner.
"Bruges! I've decided. We are moving to Belgium."
Mother's fork froze on its way to her mouth. She glared, unable to argue with him in front of us. "Isn't that a little sudden, my dear?" The set of her lips showed her displeasure.
"Just thinking of you and the children. The exchange of the pound's favour will afford you a few luxuries, my dear. Better lifestyle and all that."
Father tempered his pronouncement and attempted a mollifying smile.
"What's Belgium, Mother?" I whispered later as she tucked Teddy in beside me. "I'll sail in a pea-green boat over the water, like the owl and the pussy-cat who went to sea."
That move to Belgium was my first of many moves to come. Like Mother and my siblings, I soon learned not to put down roots. Chess pieces moved at whim, house to house, pension to pension, back and forth between England and Belgium, with no upheaval to himself, Father disrupted us from afar. So, when I became a refugee at nine, I thought of it as just another move.